What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It has been 429 days since October 7th. Since that time, 45,515, we know that's an undercount, Palestinians have been murdered and countless more have starved to death, been buried under rubble, died as a result of not being able to access critical medical care, contracted formerly contained communicable diseases, and so many others, too numerous to name. We have spent most of our Mondays documenting those horrors and pushing back on Zionist and mainstream media misinformation and disinformation with the aim of helping you. That's their aim, is to help you justify a genocide. We continue that coverage today with a new segment where we will alternate weeks speaking with organizers with the Palestinian Youth Movement and the Arab Resource Organizing Center, or AROC. Today's guest is Samer Arabi, a member of AROC, who also co-hosts the weekly Palestine Solidarity Announcements every Friday at noon. Good morning, Samer. Thanks so much for coming back to the show.
Morning, Kat. Great to be here.
Samer, we're going to start with Lebanon, and I'm going to read something from an article in the Atlantic Council that says, a fragile ceasefire took effect on November 27th, ending, that's in air quotes for me anyway, the 13-month conflict between Hezbollah and Israel prompted by the October 7th. I'm not going to read that part. But it seems that Israel Defense Forces seems to have missed the memo. We're pushing back on bad narrative here. Within hours of the 4 a.m. ceasefire coming into force, Israeli troops inside Lebanon opened fire at vehicles as tens of thousands of Lebanese who had earlier fled the fighting attempted to return to their homes. In the town of Qiyam, the scene of fierce fighting in October and November, three journalists were wounded by Israeli gunfire while covering the return of residents. The same day, the IDF slapped a ban on Lebanese returning to dozens of border villages, declaring them a restricted area and imposed a curfew from 5 p.m. to 7 a.m. south of the Litani River, which runs anywhere between 3 and 30 kilometers north of the border. That is how the so-called ceasefire began. What's played out since then? I know it's a lot, so you just do broad strokes.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, it's been a lot. All of it continues to be a lot. And that ceasefire is particularly messy, made significantly more so, of course, by what's been happening in Syria for the past couple of days, which will change everything, unsurprisingly. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's really clear that that ceasefire has never really taken effect, right? The original idea is, you know, supposed to be based on the UN Resolution 1701, which returns things more or less to the state that was agreed on after Israel got their butts kicked in 2006, in the last time they tried to invade Lebanon. But you know, things are significantly different on the ground here. The balance of forces have changed quite a bit. And I think what we're seeing is Israel trying to continue to exert operational control over southern Lebanon, despite the fact that they're more or less explicitly required to not do that by the ceasefire agreement. So at this point, Israel has violated that ceasefire agreement well over 100 times. It was 100 times last week. So now we're probably at 150 or more.
It was 100 times on the first day.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, so I mean, like, if, you know, to the extent that this ceasefire even exists, you know, which I think is a really open question at this point, and whether or not things return to the status quo will be something we'll have to see in the next few days. And one thing that, you know, folks should be apprised of is that Israel has already threatened that if the ceasefire collapses, which, like, what ceasefire? But, you know, if the pretense of a ceasefire collapses, they're promising to go in harder than they were before, right? Basically to treat the state of Lebanon as the enemy warring party, as opposed to just the party of Hezbollah, which means broader public destruction, you know, which is hard to imagine, right? We're always like, how much worse can it get? It can always get worse. And that's something I think we need to be prepared for in the coming weeks.
A couple of threads to tug on there, Samer. I mean, I think one is, Hezbollah is not the Lebanese government. And inside of the ceasefire, right, the Lebanese government is required to somehow control Hezbollah or else. And to me, when you were talking, and it's not a thought that had struck me before, that's the same blanket ideology that the Zionist forces have used in Palestine, right, saying, oh, we're not coming after the Palestinian people. We're looking for Hamas. So it's just like rinse and repeat, yeah?
Oldest trick in the book, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's that common Israeli tactic that never seems to work, right? It's always based on the idea that somehow there exists like a broad popular mass of people who are actually totally fine with Israel, and it's just like this group of militants that's their problem. But they don't seem to understand, they can't quite internalize the fact that, like, no, actually, like, it's the broad populace, right, that stands against, you know, the country that's bombing them into oblivion. And so this divide and conquer approach never works, right? You know, this idea that you can somehow cause mass civilian death, and that's going to be the thing that turns people against, you know, the few people who are trying to fight the mass civilian death, like, just doesn't make any sense. They've been doing it for, you know, decades now, and it has yet once yielded any meaningful results, but here we are.
One of the other things about the ceasefire, and I don't think I said this at the beginning, but for my listeners, I haven't been tracking this, so the ceasefire is brokered by the United States and France, and it's held in the UN, a body that Netanyahu has shown nothing but contempt for throughout this entire process. But the United States, and the United States, you know, a loyal Israel supporter. But the thing is, there's no actual accountability mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so in the ceasefire resolution, it says, sure, come tell this body. And France has actually come to the table and said, I think this is when it was 52 times, France came to the table and said, okay, Israel has violated this 52 times. And Israel said, yeah, and... But even if the body was going to take it seriously, there's nothing like, okay, they've done this, so now we're going to, correct?
That's exactly right. And you know, for France to even have played that role, you know, it was sort of required to walk back its commitment to arrest Netanyahu based on those ICC arrest warrants. You know, this is like the U.S. strong-arming them into taking a softer position on that. So, you know, France, like, basically bowed. You know, I still think that they're going to hold the ICC warrants, despite the sort of walking back they did this past week, just to hold what is effectively a ceremonial role. Because as you said, right, the UN actually doesn't have any power of enforcement here. It doesn't have any inclination to do anything more than it has done, which is sort of have UNIFIL troops, you know, this United Nations interim force for Lebanon, which, you know, by their existence sort of slow down Israeli offensives, but not much. You know, as we've seen, Israel is perfectly happy to murder UN troops in the same breath that it's, you know, so, you know, its so-called attack on Hezbollah. The real power here, unsurprising to folks who are listening, is not, in fact, in the ceasefire document that was signed by the parties, but in the private letter that the United States sent to the Israeli government, you know, which is a separate document from the ceasefire, but obviously a part and parcel of the broader negotiations, guaranteeing Israel its right to self-defense in Lebanon, which, like, the Orwellian nature of that sentence, you know, self-defense in another country. And that really is where I think we're seeing the real enforcement, basically saying that, yeah, the United States will continue, you know, after a year of genocide, will continue to use its formidable political power and military to allow Israel to continue to strike targets in Lebanon. And that's exactly what we're seeing, right? It's a direct consequence of Biden once again, you know, providing maximal support to Israel and Israel just going hog wild with it.
I mean, it wasn't funny. I mean, it's not funny, but at this point, it's laugh or scream.
What can you do but laugh?
Alternate, yeah. you know, and organize, right? As
that's right.
As we do.
That's right.
I mean, one of the things that I was thinking when I was reading through the ceasefire agreement and could see, like, all the stuff we're talking about right away, I was like, okay, well, this is just, I mean, this is smoke and mirrors. Hezbollah's not stupid, right? They're not, like, it's not like they don't understand what is happening. And I can't imagine that they're going to be played for stupid for very much longer, meaning that it's very likely that we're probably going to see escalation of conflict pretty soon.
Yeah.
You know, you agree?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's tricky, right? There's so much we don't know. But yes, clearly, I think they're going into it very level-headed and trying to think about, you know, the best way to come out of what is a really bad situation for everybody, right? I mean, there's no question Hezbollah has taken its blows, you know?
Yeah, so, yeah, a lot of their leadership murdered.
Yeah. And so, you know, like, even just the changing calculus around the idea of, like, the, you know, maintaining both hot fronts until there's a ceasefire in Gaza, you know, like, that's no longer even on the table, right? So where that calculus goes, but it is really hard to say, but I think one thing that we can pretty definitively say is that if Israel continues to violate the ceasefire at this level, like there's no reason not to think that, Hezbollah will basically just, it will have no choice but to respond in kind. And we've seen a little bit of that already, but not very much. Like there's been quite a bit of restraint, but that's going to change. And I think that's going to lead to, it has the potential to lead to, it's really hard to know what's going to happen these days, but it has the potential to lead to a horrifying escalation that I think will require us here to mobilize very strongly to do what we can to limit, if nothing else, the US's role in fueling that conflict.
Agreed. I'm gonna tug on the Palestine thread that you touched on in your response, right? So in terms of the history of this conflict between Hezbollah and the Zionist forces, there's been a long-standing tension, but this escalated for sure when Hezbollah opened up a support front, right, to attempt to impact the genocide in Gaza, and did say initially they wouldn't stop until the genocide ended. But that's not one of the 13 points of the ceasefire agreement. So I'm throwing the question back to you, I guess, that you posed in your previous answer. Like, what does that mean for what Hezbollah is obligated to do, and what does it mean for Palestinians?
I mean, I think it's a sign of the way things are developing in Gaza, and it's a really unfortunate consequence of the fact that, that support front was specifically designed around the idea of forcing Israel's hand into a ceasefire, in Gaza, right? And doing something to mitigate the extent of this genocide. And I think what we've seen now, after what, 14 months at this point, is that, there are no lines for Israel. Like, no pressure being brought to bear is doing anything to reduce what's happening here, right? Like, the prospect of a ceasefire has been basically absent for, a year. It's become abundantly clear, I think, to everyone that Israel has never had any interest in a ceasefire in Gaza whatsoever. And so, given that, I think the calculus there had to change, right? Which, what it means, it's hard to say, but it's certainly not good for Gaza that, Israel can now, well, if that ceasefire had gone through, right, then Israel would be redeploying its troops away from the Lebanese border and back to Gaza. But it's hard to say, and I think, like, it has had a really material effect on the trajectory of Israel's genocide, where not only is it required to split its military forces across these two fronts, but it's also the collapse in morale, that we were already seeing in terms of their military engagements in Gaza, have increased by an order of magnitude by the fact that the IDF actually had to contend with Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon. You're seeing reservists called up, and only 10% of them actually showing up. Like, the extent to which the morale crisis is overwhelming the IDF, I think, is a huge victory in terms of limiting their ability to carry out this genocide. And yeah, I don't know where it goes from there, but I think we'll see it. There are two clear paths here, right? Whether, well, each of those paths fork, but there's two clear paths, at least on the Lebanon side, which is, like, at some point the ceasefire will in fact come through, right? Like, the bombing will stop, because it's in the interest of both sides. Or it won't, and it'll return to a hot war, or basically continue what's been happening, which is the continuation of the hot war. But then the second fork there is whether or not a ceasefire in Gaza will in fact happen in the next few weeks. Like, there's been a surprising amount of movement on that just in the last day. So whether that's a possibility now, not something we considered before, but all of these things, I think, would have really big impacts, and we need to be prepared for all of those eventualities in terms of how we're organizing here, which is
Well,
hard.
why don't you give, yes, it is. Why don't you give my listeners an update on what has moved, in terms of the ceasefire potential, in Gaza?
Yeah, so I mean, ceasefire, I think, is a bit of a misnomer because it doesn't really sound like a sort of, quote unquote, permanent end to the hostilities is really in the cards here, but a temporary cessation of hostilities, which the Israelis described as a gift to Trump, to give you a sense of the sort of, like, political analysis that underpins that, is being negotiated to the extent that, as far as I understand it, at least, Hamas is now preparing lists of political prisoners that they would want released in a prisoner exchange swap, which means that, you know, there's at least that level of dialogue on the table. And it would be a just over a month, I think, cessation of hostilities. The specific number of days is weirdly ambiguous, but it's somewhere around 40. And then, you know, would be like an exchange of prisoners, basically, right? Like the Hamas and the other armed forces who are holding Israeli hostages. Really important that piece that folks don't remember, which is that Hamas is not, in fact, holding all of those hostages. In exchange for a number of Palestinian political prisoners. But no full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, no prospect for the end of the war, really just a chance for folks to catch their breath, it's not nothing.
Except for, and you know, some people accuse me of being a pessimist. The last time that this happened, there was supposed to be an exchange of prisoners. Israel released people and then waited, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds, and then rearrested them.
Yep.
So they didn't play by the rules then, and there's really no expectation that they're going to play by the rules now. Yeah?
No, they never do. And they almost will certainly try the playbook again, yeah.
Right. All right, I've got a couple more things I've got to touch with you, and I've got a limited time to do it, but I can't let you go without talking about the fall of the Syrian government on Sunday due to a people's movement. What, if any, impact does this have on Palestine with the genocide, the tensions already in the region?
Yeah. Ooh. Everyone's favorite topic. the Syria stuff is hard. It's really, really hard. And, you know, I say this as a Syrian and as someone who myself has a somewhat of a contentious relationship with the former government of Syria. I'm actually banned from going back to Syria for the past decade or so. So I think there are different pieces of this that folks need to hold at the same time, which is really, really hard to do. We saw years ago how the Syrian civil war really exposed a lot of fractures in the ways that people see things. And, you know, like it really divided the Syrian community in the United States. It really divided the broader Arab community. And that there's a danger of that happening again. And I really want folks to sort of like, appreciate the importance of a strategic unity across all of our community right now and make sure that, like, you know, despite the different ways that this analysis cuts, and there are many different ways this analysis cuts, that at the end of the day, like, you know, we need to be unified in our goal of stopping this genocide first and foremost above everything else. And then in addition to that, like, you know, our hope for a, you know, liberated and empowered homeland, right, that allows our people to live with dignity. So, you know, holding all of that is not always easy, you know, like centering not only the fight against imperialism, but also, you know, the domestic fight against authoritarianism sometimes those things clash, right? And I think we are seeing a little bit of that now where, I think you can't see the images coming from the, like, release of the political prisoners held in Saydnaya prison, right, just outside of Damascus, where, you know, hundreds, thousands of leftist, socialist, organizers, communists, people who are, like, you know, fighting for the liberation of Palestine are being freed from those prisons right now. And that's a beautiful moment, right? It's hard not to feel the power of that and, like, the meaning and hope that that sort of produces. You know, at the same time, Syria, the old Syrian government was a member of the resistance axis, right? And was a really critical conduit for the military challenge of the Israeli state. And that's gone now. You know, for all intents and purposes, that's gone now. Syria was always a very imperfect, to be very generous, an imperfect member of that so-called resistance axis. You know, the front on the Golan Heights has been quiet this entire time, unlike what Hezbollah has been doing for the past year. You know, the Syrian state has not done anything anywhere near similar. You know, everybody has their own role to play or whatever, but there's no question, I think, that in the short term, at least, this emboldens Israel and it weakens the resistance's axis ability to resist Israel. You know, whether in the long run that could conceivably be worth it is a question we just can't definitively answer, but I think we need to prepare for, I think, a very difficult time ahead.
And I'm sure we will be bringing you on to talk about how this all unfolds in the coming weeks. Summer, last question in limited time. Amnesty International report released breaks down the atrocities Israel has committed into five categories: unprecedented scale and magnitude, intent to destroy, killing and causing serious bodily or mental harm, inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about physical destruction, and accountability for genocide. The report goes into great detail based on 212 interviews, records, data, research report, news articles, etc. In what ways, and it's pretty graphic, right? Like, we understand, if you didn't understand before, the intentional destruction, for instance, of infrastructure, right, that allowed sanitation and water systems to collapse. In what ways is a report like this helpful at this point in time, right, 429 days in? Who are they talking to? And as an organizer, where do you see the potential leverage of such a report? 90 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it's stark, right, to see. It's nothing we haven't been saying for, you know, a year at this point, but it is still stark, right, to really see it all written out like that. It's a very meticulously researched, very thoughtful report that I would definitely recommend. I wouldn't tell everybody to read it. It's 300 pages, but skim it. I would encourage folks
executive
to skim it.
Executive summary's pretty good.
Yeah, the executive summary is great. Just read that. That's fantastic. Yeah. But it's an important tool in our tool belt. You know, it does feel like just another thing, you know, and down the line, you know, there have been many of these, you know, institutions and people coming around to call this genocide, but that's a building consensus that we need to capitalize on. So, you know, I would really encourage folks to spread that report, to send it to your elected officials, to, like, you know, make sure that it is highlighted in a way that forces people to grapple with this question. You know, I think folks... The United States political establishment is still obviously refusing to use that word, the big G word, to refer to what's happening in Gaza, even though that's plainly what it is. It's a genocide. And the more that we can hold that as the sort of standard for what is happening, the more that, you know, moves with that. I think, like, in addition to just people sitting with the gravity of that term and what it means, you know, there's questions of complicity here, right? That a big reason the United States doesn't want to call it genocide is because then they're complicit in the genocide through the, you know, the arming and the diplomatic cover that they're providing to the state that's committing the genocide. And that puts them not only in a complicated moral position, which we know our elected leaders don't care about, but in a complicated legal position, which they may care about. And so, right, you know, that's an opportunity for us to really push them in a way that we hadn't been able to push them before. And so, you know, it feels like a small thing given that we've been talking about it for so long, but I do think it's an important advocacy tool, and I would encourage folks to use it as such.
Right on, Samer. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Kat. It's always great to be here.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.